This is Brock and Saul.
Brock Huard and Marcus. Sorry about just
Mike.
On Seattle Sports.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
You were not exactly Joe Capp there in the pocket.
Presented by Simply Seattle.
Now here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Saul.
Hi, everybody. Brock and Salk Show, Seattle Sports on 710CLSports.com and the Seattle Sports application. You may not know it, may not feel like it, but it is a formal Friday today. And of course, we're also on all those podcast platforms. You can find us there as well. All three of us made it to work today, despite various questions about our ability to do so and various shortcuts that were taken. Maura is here. Justin is here. I am here. And we did make it despite our night at Ludacris last night.
We are just all highly caffeinated.
Yes, I have caffeine.
Trying to be.
It's a rare thing, but I am drinking some caffeinated tea this morning. I don't want to alarm anybody.
Nice.
So generally that means that I've got to say like, hey, whatever I say today, I won't remember. So
yeah. I had the panic wake up.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, for yeah.
Yeah.
Be like, I don't even want to look because I know I'm late. Look. I was like, oh, I'm good.
Phew.
And okay. My alarm was actually going off, but it was quiet. So yep. I was like, oh, shoot, how long has this been happening? Yeah. And then made it on time.
Take a shower?
Feel good about it.
Yeah.
Nah, you guys not. Both informed me that you didn't. I did squeeze that in.
I'm impressed. I did not. I woke up late. First, I mean, not late enough to be late, but like 5 minutes late enough so that I was like,
I wanted to.
I don't have time to shower. Or I'm not going to make it. So I did. I skipped it. Skipped the shower today. So that's, yeah.
I'm not proud. Can you go? Are you already doing a range for Ludo for us?
Me?
No, Maura.
Yeah, Maura's. Was this your favorite last night?
I kind of forgot about this one, so I was excited when it came on.
Oh. It's a hit.
Is this what you think of me not showering? How low could you go?
No.
Like, ugh. Like, that's just lower than the low. Maybe a slightly different meaning than how Luda intended it when he first wrote and recorded that one. Ton of fun last night. So just to pay off the story, and G will be in at 8:30. So we'll chat with him about it and kind of go through some more detail and give some different perspectives maybe on how everybody interpreted different parts of the night. I guess the first thing I would say before we get to the evening in general, kind of where we all went and how it went, don't listen to anything G says. That man's a liar. He's just a flat liar. Everything he says, everything that comes out of his mouth, I just want to like preface it now at 6:03 and let you know that G's just a liar. He is. He's a liar. He manipulates every single thing that is said. He turns himself into the constant victim.
Oh, no.
He's the world's biggest liar.
Oh, no.
So I just want that part out there first.
Can we also say that he has a lovely home and he was a very nice host?
I was going to get to all of that.
Okay,
I promise.
Right.
I'm going to get to the whole evening.
Balance.
Before I get to what we did and our perceptions and what we saw, I just want everyone to know that when G comes in at 8:30 and tells his side of the story, he's a liar. He just is. He lies about everything. He's like a pathological liar.
What are you worried about?
Yeah, what happened?
Just little things, right? Like, oh, you guys ditched me after. It's like, no, we didn't. You ran away. Like, he's constantly the victim. So I just want everyone to know that G's a liar. Now, as for the evening, I picked up Justin and Maura. We all drove down to Tacoma, and we got to G's house, which he said was right next to EQC. It was a good 15, 20 minutes away. And see, liar. Oh, I live right there. Come by my house. Like, no, you don't.
Tacoma terms, it was pretty close.
I mean, it was closer than where we live, but it was not close. Anyway, so we get to G's house, and Maura, you couldn't be more right. G's home is lovely. I've been there once before his remodel, but now it is absolutely gorgeous. Looks great. Kind of a cool black and white motif with it. It was awesome. Nice gray flooring.
Very
like
sleek.
Yeah, very great word for it. Very sleek. Looked good. Kitchen was nice. He had the sushi all ready for you guys. How was the sushi?
Fantastic.
Yeah?
Really I good. Loved it. Yeah. Shout out Trappers. I asked when he told us he was getting sushi, and back of my mind, I'm like, you're going to Trappers, aren't you? And it was. It was great. I'd never been, so I was like kind of waiting on it.
Okay.
I liked it. I'm glad he, something I never, Maura and I talked about, is we never get that to go. Like, I never think about ordering sushi to take home.
So I don't do it very often either.
It's great.
It's one of those foods that translates good, but not perfectly to being at home.
But it was
right?
great.
So good. Oh, awesome. All right. So you guys had your sushi. I have my Eastside Weight Loss Clinic meal. G was kind enough to let
chili-ish.
Me. Yeah, it's a beanless chili. It had bison meat in it.
It was
pretty good. It's actually pretty good. I mean, it's fine. It's not like, It's you know what's good about it? You can make like an entire week at a time and then just sort of like, you know, generally I eat it for lunch, but because it's easy to travel, took it for dinner last night. Yeah. So that was fun. And so we make our way, we chatted for a while, watched a little hoops, enjoyed G's cats. And then we made it to the show. And well, I shouldn't say that. There was, I guess, a little time in between where, you know, somebody had to sit down at a blackjack table and just hang out and take money. I mean, somebody had to do that.
It was free money day? Who was that?
It was free money day. Oh. Yeah. Some very interesting hands last night. It was a fun little just solo one heads up against dealer. So that was a lot of fun. You know how much I enjoy my blackjack. So that was awesome. I had a great old time doing that. And then we made it into the show. What did you guys think? As we were there, so we get into the huge ballroom there, the huge auditorium at EQC, and like DJ was just like pumping out hits, right? It was loud. Yep. We had great seats. Thank you to everybody there. We had great seats. What were you thinking sort of at, before Luda came out, but as the DJ was kind of getting going?
I was doing a lot of people watching to see where I ranked in the age range.
Yeah.
And also based on what, you know, my outfit was like, if I actually fit in visually. Like
okay.
If people walked by, we're going to do like a, what is this idiot doing here?
What did you think?
I felt pretty comfortable. I saw a lot of Mariners gear, so I felt good about that.
Good.
A lot of satin jackets. Felt double good about that.
Right.
So I decided to rock my All-Star jacket that I was like, well, what else can I wear this loud?
I would say you fit in perfectly with what you were
wearing.
Thank
you. And that disarmed me, made me feel really good.
G obviously fit in. He fits in wherever he goes. So G looked great in his 5 outfit. 5 out of 10, he said. He didn't want to show us up.
Yep.
And so G was wearing a 5.
When we walked into the whole venue together, because G and I drove his car and the two of you, so we showed up separately and walked in separately. 3 people right off the bat immediately just like gave G like a, what's up?
G? Yeah, what's everybody up, G? Knows G. And so I would say Maura was dressed more conservatively than some of the other women who were there last night. Just frankly, not saying that was a problem. Just there were some less conservative outfits.
It happens.
It's more a comment on the other outfits than on what Maura was wearing, if that makes sense.
Thing.
Would you agree with that, Maura?
I guess I hadn't really noticed, but yeah, maybe.
You didn't spend the same amount of time looking around the room and just seeing what
Ludacris
everybody
kept
else
telling
is
everyone to look at all the women. Where are all the sexy ladies at? Look at all the sexy ladies.
It's a big part of Luda's act. So
yeah.
And then I did indeed wear a sweatshirt, a hoodie that G gave me last night, which he's not getting back. I like it. I'm keeping it. That thing's mine now.
The
moving forward.
I don't think he thought you were going to like the options.
I kind of like
Twitter
them.
Are great, but like it is. So on the each side of the, do you call it a hoodie?
And it's a hoodie, yeah.
A hooded shirt. It has what are essentially gold bedazzles going down both sides of skulls.
As skulls, yeah. There's some silver, I think, in there, too. It's mostly gold on black. You can see it on
really
most
good.
All, I think all four
very
of
on
our
brand for you.
Twitter feed. Yes, yeah. It's what I normally wear.
Yeah,
you know
pull
what?
It off.
If it didn't have the, what did you say, the bedazzles on it, the rhinestones?
Yeah.
I think I could have worn something like that. And probably have worn similar things, but without the rhinestones. That gave it a little
extra flair.
Little extra flair. So yeah, that was kind of fun. How was the show?
I've seen Luda before. And
you have? I didn't think I realized
it took me a while to realize. Like, you know what? I actually saw him at the White River Amphitheater like when I was like 22. But because it was that long ago, I was like, oh, definitely there's going to be a shift in the way he performs. And like his voice is going to sound different and maybe he's not going to move around as fast as he used to. Like, oh, no, he's a showman. Like he's very good. He's got this down pat.
Yeah.
He could do this in his sleep. You could have just woken him up and been like, hey, can you play 16 songs? And,
yep. Yeah. On it. Yeah. And he did a great job. He hit most of his famous verses and all his big lines and stuff. That was great. He had just a DJ and one other guy up there. I found that like back in the day, it seemed like a lot of rap acts were a lot of like 12 guys up just sort of yelling at the same time and you couldn't really hear a lot of what was being said and it didn't sound like it did on the record, and I didn't think that at all last. I thought Luda was great. I thought it was really fun.
He does so many great guest spots on other people's songs that I didn't expect to hear those, but he did a good job of just, he would just play like the chorus of that song and go straight into his verse.
It's perfect.
But it is kind of, I had the same experience going to see Tribe Called Quest a while ago, that I think like once these acts get like a little bit older, they try to be concise, so it is more of like a medley of parts of songs, and sometimes you just want to hear a full song.
Yeah,
that's the only complaint I have.
I think I would agree. More full songs, less asking who's better, the left side or the right side. I got to tell you guys, I love a show. I do. I love almost any version of live music. I love going out to see it, so I try not to complain. And I had a blast last night. Luda was awesome. Can we be done with the, like, left side versus right side, who's louder garbage?
It was smart at the beginning, but it went a little long.
Dude, he did it, like, 12 times over the course of the night. Okay, you want to do that once? Fine. But, like, come on. Do we really need to battle the left and the right side to pretend to find out who's louder? This can't continue. It is 2024. This has been going on for 50 years. It needs to stop. I would like somebody in power to declare a moratorium on finding out which side of a venue is louder. Then I will be happy. All right. We'll come back. We'll give you guys some things you actually need to know in sports. We will be talking a little bit today. We got Mariners. We got John Schneider, who was on with Wyman and Bob yesterday. And we've got just an epic watershed moment tonight. Once again, stick around. We'll tell you about it next on Brock and Salk.
Need to know.
15 minutes past every hour with Brock and Salk.
Here's what you need to know. Up first.
You know, it's nice when you get exactly what you need. And for the Mariners, they needed a day off yesterday, coming off of that awful loss to Cleveland. Just kind of think about it. And that's what they did. They traveled to Milwaukee, spent the day there, and now hopefully come out firing on all cylinders against the Brewers. By the way, Milwaukee been pretty good. Maybe the best team they've faced so far. And the guy they're going to face right off the bat, Freddy Peralta, tonight has been nasty in his first start, allowed just one run. In fact, only allowed one hit in six innings against the Mets. He's a pretty good pitcher. He'll go against Logan Gilbert tonight. So, where's the team at? Scott Service on with Wyman and Bob yesterday.
You know, there's no magical steps. You do this, and then this happens. There's going to be some bumps in the road. It's going to take a little while for this group to figure it out. But I said it leaving spring training. I still believe it today. We have a very talented team. We haven't played well. I thought yesterday's game was not a good game by any means. And our guys realize that. We need to get better, more consistent offensively. But hopefully the road trip helps. Playing good teams. Obviously, Milwaukee's off to a good start here. Then we go to Toronto, teams that are very capable and teams that will be fighting for the playoffs here when we get to the end of the season. So, but it's an opportunity for our team to really come together. I was just coming in here and I saw about 10 of our guys going out to dinner tonight. Those things are important. Start spending time together away from the park, getting to know each other a little bit more. And hopefully, you know, like I said, our team will come together on this road trip.
No, he's absolutely right about that. And it is, you know, a lot more of a turnover than I think we've talked about. But, you know, as good as it will be to have them go out to dinner and feel comfortable, what would be great is if they just have that one game where you break out, score seven or eight runs, get to a pitcher, everybody hits, everybody gets into the action, get a win, get your confidence back, see your numbers start to rise, and then go out and kind of do everything from there. You know, one of the problems they've had is that they've seen, as we've heard now, more curves and spin than any other team in the league by a large margin. Will it continue? Aaron Goldsmith says he doesn't think so.
Over the first seven games, not only did the Mariners see the fewest 4 and 2 seam fastballs in baseball, they saw the fewest 4 and 2 seam fastballs in baseball by far, like outlier lowest amount, 30% 4 and 2 seamers. Nobody else was especially close to that. So I think they obviously need to learn to make some in-game adjustments with that. But I also think that that number is not sustainable and there will be more fastballs in their crystal ball. When they look into the future?
I'm sure there will be, but I think it's going to be up to them to make that happen. You're going to have to lay off the pitches that you don't want to hit and force them to come to you. I think they're capable of doing it. Hopefully that starts tonight in Milwaukee.
Here's the second thing you need to
know. All right, we are officially into crunch time now, leading up to the draft. John Schneider working hard. He's on with Wyman and Bob yesterday, explains where they're at.
Yeah, next 3 weeks, you know, we're going to be working through the weekend. We're going to have a great weekend. We have these weekends scheduled just like really quiet here, being able to study. So we're going to have one of those all day Saturday, all day Sunday, where we're kind of like just sweeping again, going through guys that have worked out real well or medical grades have been affected. We just had medical grade. We had a medical meeting a couple nights ago. And so, you know, you lose a bunch of players there or you have to move them down, which is a bummer. Or sometimes you gain players based on different orthopedic grades, but that's kind of rare. But we'll go through this weekend, and then the scouts will come in on Tuesday, and then we'll start our meetings on Wednesday, and we'll just attack it like we haven't, I'm being sarcastic here, but like we haven't started before, you know, we're just like really open mind. We
Yeah, so they kind of almost get back to basics. There's a lot of studying still left to go. One thing we learned yesterday is Laviska Shenault here, partially because teams, it sounds like, are really going to need two kick returners. And with the exit of DJ Dallas, who never struck me as much of a kick returner, they needed two. So Dee Eskridge is here, and now you bring in Laviska Shenault as well. I still wonder whether or not this will evolve into having some bigger kick returners just based on the style that you're going to need now, with almost it being more like a running play than, you know, the wide open field with all of the speed. Not that speed won't matter, but I do wonder if we'll see more backup running backs returning kicks as opposed to wide receivers, corners, and some of the guys who have done it in the past.
Here's the third thing you need to know.
All right, let's go. I can confidently say there's never been a more anticipated night of women's college hoops than this evening. South Carolina, NC State, the opening act, although that's probably an unfair title to put on South Carolina. They're really good, but they are totally dominant. They have been all year. The main event, though, will be the storied UConn program led by Coach Gino Auriemma. His star this year, Paige Beckers, and the rest of that crew against Caitlin Clark and her Iowa squad. We know what, 12.3 million watch Monday. What's tonight going to be? 14 million? 15 million? And if Iowa wins, we'll see what that looks like for the finals. As for Caitlin Clark, she scores a lot of points, but she didn't want to focus on that.
People didn't really ever think we would get to the Final Four, and now to be here back-to-back times is amazing. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, people aren't going to remember how many points I scored. People aren't going to remember, you know, people may remember that we were in the Final Four twice, but people aren't going to remember, like, my buzzer-beating shots versus whoever. Like, that's not going to matter to people in the end. I hope they remember, you know, how we made them feel, how we brought joy to their lives, how we gave their families something to scream about on the TV on the weekends. You know, I hope those are the biggest things that people remember. I hope, you know, all the young boys and girls remember the joy that we played with and how we took 10 seconds of our time to sign their autograph and that inspired them to, you know, be whatever they want to be. I think that goes for, like, I think I'm speaking for our entire team. And, you know, that's what we're kind of the most proud of, the way we've carried ourselves through this entire process.
It's a really nice sentiment. She's at a point now where she's about to be just a superstar in terms of who knows her, where, you know, what her endorsement possibilities are, money that she can make. If that is her own sentiment, kudos to her. That is a wonderful thought. And if she's being coached, she's being coached very, very well on how to handle it. That is just a really wonderful, wonderful thought that she presents there.
Like a 22-year-old.
No, I like that.
That's awesome.
Men get underway tomorrow. NC State, Purdue, 309. Purdue, a 9-point favorite over NC State. And then Alabama, UConn at 550. UConn, a 12-point favorite over Alabama. All right. That's everything you need to know. Quarter past every hour here on the Brock and Salk Show. And by the way, we're going to come back to that Caitlin Clark clip probably in about a half hour or so, because I think there's like a very important underlying feature of what she's saying. Moore has mentioned it before, and the more I live my life, the more important I think it is what Moore has said. So we'll come back to that, as I've said, about 7 o'clock. First, though, where are the Mariners really at? How bad was the first week? Was it terrible? Was it as bad as it felt? Were there maybe some signs of things that aren't nearly as terrible as we might think? Aaron Goldsmith, I thought, presented a really good down-the-middle view on this yesterday. Stick around. You'll hear it next. Brock and Salk, Seattle Sports on 710.
This is Brock and Salk.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio. Weekdays 6 to 10.
On Seattle Sports and the Seattle Sports app.
All right, rolling along here, Brock and Salk, Seattle Sports on 710. Brock will have a draft profile coming up at 9 o'clock. And then you know who's joining us at 9:30? The Groz. I haven't even really mentioned that today.
Gosh, it's been so long.
I know. We haven't talked to the Groz in a while. So we're going to do that at 9:30, check in with him and get some of his thoughts on the start of the season. And actually, I mean, really everything from Pete Carroll to Mike McDonald to the craziness at UW and the Mariners season. So we'll talk to the Groz coming up an hour from now. Yes, a huge focus of the morning has been the Mariners homestand, which just concluded 3-4, not 1-6, although that's certainly the way it felt. It was 3-4, but some real ugly play in there as well. Aaron Goldsmith journeyed with the team last night off to Milwaukee. Kind enough to take a few minutes with us this morning. Goldie, good morning.
Mike, good morning. I challenge you to ask one question like Brock would during this segment, will not be easy.
We only have 25 minutes. Generally, his questions take about 15. So what you're hoping for is what, two questions?
Well, I don't know. I just want to see you channel your inner Brock. I think we all do. That's all.
All right. Good morning, though. So let me start by talking about my children and then kind of go on from there. Ask you about your body and how your hair is handling the humidity in Wisconsin. All right. So we just had a homestand that was suboptimal. Let's say that. Of the things you saw, because there's a lot of panic in the streets today, what was actually concerning and what was not concerning?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I didn't channel my inner Brock. I started off by asking you a good question right off the bat.
Yeah, it really makes me think. Well done. I'm also thinking kind of like short term, long term. Like, let's start with the defense, right? Like, I'm not terrified by the defense. I think after yesterday, it could be easy to say, throw your hands up in the air and say, oh, well, this is going to be the worst defensive team in baseball, right? Like, I don't think that's true. And I think the defense can get better. They certainly have the right infield coach to do that in Perry Hill. And I think we have seen certainly the fruits of his labor during his time here, right? Like, J.P. Crawford, when he came to Seattle, was far from what he is right now. Eugenio Suarez, when he finished his tenure in Seattle, he looked a lot different defensively than when he initially got here. That's hard work by the players, and it's hard work by Perry Hill. So I think that gets better. The difference is, Mike, it doesn't get better immediately tomorrow, right? Like, that will need to evolve and might take a little bit of time as the season goes on. Offensively, like, that's the other concern, right? I think the Mariners obviously swung and missed quite a bit. I think that there's a good chance that levels out based on opponent. I find it very interesting that over the first seven games, not only did the Mariners see the fewest 4- and 2-seam fastballs in baseball, they saw the fewest 4- and 2-seam fastballs in baseball by far, like outlier lowest amount, 30% 4- and 2-seamers. Nobody else was especially close to that. So I think they obviously need to learn to make some in-game adjustments with that. But I also think that that number is not sustainable and there will be more fastballs in their crystal ball when they look into the future. But for right now, both those things are a concern. I don't necessarily think that they will plague the team for 162 games at this level.
Yeah, it's a weird start to the season, right? Because there have been some sloppy elements that I think are concerning, at least to me. And then there have been other things where it's like, well, Julio Cal Raleigh, Jorge Polanco, and, well, certainly those three, none of them have, and Mitch Garver, none of them have hit a home run yet this year. Like, I don't feel like that's something that's likely to go for 162 games.
Yeah, I mean, like, Shohei just hit his first home run yesterday, and they played two games before the Mariners ever stepped on the field for opening day, right, in Korea. So I don't – and Yordan Alvarez hadn't homered until yesterday. Like, the timing of when a guy first hits a home run or first – now, if they hadn't had a hit yet, that would be like, okay, well, you know, I kind of want to get that monkey off your back. But, like, that kind of thing, I'm not fazed by that at all. I haven't written down – a single player's offensive numbers for either the Mariners or their opponents for the first seven games. I was actually just thinking, like, I might start doing that tomorrow. We've been in for a week. I might start jotting some of those things down. But the reason I do that is not to put my head in the sand. I know there are people listening who think that. It's simply because, you know, it's the smallest of small samples, and anything good or bad can happen in whatever it is, 20 plate appearances for a player. It does take time. Things to level out, and so I'm not concerned whatsoever. I mean, Polanco, like you saw it, I'm sure, if the wind wasn't blowing, he would have had a home run. The wind blew his home run 14 feet to the right and like 2 feet foul. So things happen. He could easily have a home run. He could have easily maybe cleared the bases, but it was like 100 and something off the batting caught by the first baseman. So I know people don't want to hear that. I understand the frustration, but that is kind of the way this game works sometimes. Look at some of the dink and dunk hits that the Guardians had. Now, hey, credit to them. They made it work, and they won the games, at least two of them. But sometimes and there is some batted ball luck involved, and I think Polanco is certainly a victim of that a couple of times at least.
If you were Scott Servais, you know, his approach has always been really to kind of stay the course, and the patience has certainly paid off for him with some really great Julys and Augusts the last couple of years. Do you handle anything differently right now than he has in the past?
The only thing different that I'm kind of curious about, and it is a little behind the curtain and inside baseball, and I don't know how much the Mariners want to broadcast these things yet, is, you know, I was really excited, I think others were also, about the addition of Brant Brown. The Mariners were very, very aware of the offensive struggles last year. I think that's we can cite many examples of their awareness of that. And one of them was bringing in Brant Brown. And Brant Brown has a very good track record of success as a major league hitting coach with the Marlins most recently, and before that, the Dodgers, and was a former big league hitter himself. And I've spent a lot of time around Brant over the years. He's a tremendous communicator, a very smart man. And I don't think we know exactly how his role is going to be imparted on a daily basis, preparing for the opponent. I don't think that that's the Mariners trying to hide something behind a cloak. I just think it's they're getting this thing off the ground, right? And they're figuring out his role on a day-to-day basis, how to attack the opposing starting pitcher. I mean, that is such a major part of what Brant Brown does. And I think this is going to maybe take a little time to get some traction. And I don't think you change anything. I think you keep banging the same message, because right now my sense is, Mike, that there are maybe three, maybe four, maybe some days two guys who are taking that plan of action and implementing it. And it can't be two doing it and seven not, right? It needs to be the vast majority, if not hopefully all nine. So I think that's something that's probably taking some traction. But no, I wouldn't change a thing in terms of process after seven games.
Do you think you have a good sense as to what that is supposed to look like and the way it's supposed to play its way out? I mean, I know, you know, the past it's been control the zone, which I've always taken to mean, you know, essentially make good swing decisions, but also it has led to a lot of patience, right? A lot of deep counts. So you should end up with a lot of the three true outcomes, walks, home runs and strikeouts. I'm not saying that for your benefit, but for some others who maybe aren't as familiar with the term. And it feels like this year we've heard a little bit more of an emphasis on contact as opposed to patience, and maybe even as opposed to power. And I'll admit that concerns me a little bit. I know the contact was an issue last year, but any concern that they maybe have traded it for you know, traded some of the contact and power, or some of the patience and power for some contact?
Well, I'll answer that a couple of different ways. One of my concerns early in the offseason, when the plan was clearly to go this direction, trade in power and home runs for the ability to put the ball in play, I was concerned, well, like how much are the Mariners going to skew towards the Guardians style of play?
Right.
Right. Now, it's a little scarring because the Guardians just put eight runs across. But if you look at the Guardians last year, you know, they were this complete outlier team, last in home runs, nearly first in contact, and bottom line, they were 26th in runs scored. That's the finish line.
And you should point out that the Mariners were 12th in runs scored last year. When I've asked people that question, they are like, "Oh, they must have been 25th," or no, they were 12th.
No, it's a good point. And bottom line is, how many runs are you pushing across on a nightly basis, right? I really do genuinely believe that the lineup they have, now they might not have a ton of 30 homer guys, right? But I think there is consistent power by and large up and down the order. You have plenty of guys with 20 plus homer potential. It's not a bunch of pea shooters. And the other way I would answer that question, I've had a couple of conversations with Scott already this year about kind of, let's just call it offensive philosophy, And dominate the zone is still a core philosophy to this organization for both sides of the ball. One of the things that is clearly a point of emphasis this year is what they call the green box. In the clubhouse, before every game, there is a video on loop of the opposing starting pitcher, and both pitching to righties and then to lefties. And there is a green box overlaid over the strike zone. And where that green box is where that hitter gives up the majority of his hits to either righties or lefties. So one of the messages is hunt the green box, right? If you're a right-handed hitter and you know that today's opposing starting pitcher gives up the majority of his hits up and in to right-handed hitters, and that's a strength of yours, hunt the green box. I don't think the Mariners have a huge problem in this particular example that I'm kind of fabricating, but it could be tomorrow's starter, right? If you're a right-handed hitter and you chase a pitch up out of the strike zone, up and in, okay, at least you were aggressive and attacking a pitch that you know that's where he gives up his hits, okay? The problem is if on the preceding pitch you chase low and away, and then the next pitch you chase up and in, right? You can't be chasing them all over the strike zone and always a step behind. Know your strength, know his weakness. Hopefully there is some, the Venn diagram overlaps a little bit there, and chase that green box. I think that is one of the messages this year that maybe it's been there before. I'm certainly kind of new to hearing that. I'm guessing that might be a Brant Brown influence.
Yeah.
But that is definitely chase the green boxes. If we were to mic up the dugout, I would guess that every night we would hear that quite a bit.
Very interesting. Well, let's hope that that starts working, because I do think you're right. I do think there's an ability for this offense to certainly look a lot better than it has. Like, I don't think they're going to have a 550 OPS for the season. I don't think any offense, even the A's couldn't put up a 550 OPS for an entire season. So how about on the other side of things, pitching, and maybe, you know, Luis Castillo, what do you think it's been? I mean, neither outing was that bad, but also neither outing really looked like vintage Castillo. It doesn't look like it's a velocity thing. It didn't really look like a stuff thing. What did you make of his two outings?
Yeah, I've given this some thought, and I was actually thinking about this on the bus at like midnight last night, driving to the hotel. And I've got such an interesting life, as you can tell.
Clearly, yes.
And, and I haven't, I guess I would say, like, vetted this with anyone yet, but my initial thought, you know, Castillo is a really unique pitcher in terms of his mechanics. And I'm no pitching guru, but I've heard enough people who are talk about it, right? He's very rotational. He's very east to west, okay? Is that right? Yeah, east to west, left to right. And I think that is one of the attributes that makes him difficult, because there aren't guys who are like that, who are major league starting pitchers, at least ones that are successful, because it is a pretty hard group of mechanics to consistently repeat. Like, compare that to George Kirby. George Kirby has a super smooth, super clean delivery, which is not a surprise. And you add to that his natural ability to command the baseball. Like, it's almost never where you're saying, man, George's mechanics are just out of whack today, right? Because it's really near impossible for that to happen. For Castillo, just based on his mechanics and how unique they are, that does happen. And I think a pitcher who is in his style, which again isn't many, I think there is just a greater probability that over the course of 30 some odd starts, you will find yourself in a bit of a mechanical rut. I haven't heard Scott or Pete Woodworth necessarily cite to that in his first couple of starts, but I can't really imagine it being much more. Like, if you go back to opening day, as you saw, Mike, like, his first X number of fastballs were all sprayed away from left-handed hitters, right? And now maybe some of that was the adrenaline, the excitement. You had 44,000 people there. It's opening day. But I would expect Castillo, a guy with his resume and his heartbeat, after an inning, to chill, because we've seen that happen before so many times. I don't think that heartbeat played into it in the second game, right? So I'll be curious what the third start is. I'm not just kicking the can down the road, but I am also saying, like, almost anything can happen in two starts. It's magnified 10x when it's the first two starts. You're right. They weren't terrible starts, but they certainly weren't Castillo quality.
Right.
He holds himself to a higher standard than that, and the Mariners do as well. So I'll be curious what it's like second or third and fourth time through. But that's kind of my take on it after watching the first two starts.
Yeah, it's a great point about his mechanics. I had not thought about how unique they are. I mean, the one pitcher that he always reminds me of is Pedro, but that is more probably because of the pitch selection, right? And some of the movement he gets on it. And, you know, I know that that was, I think that's by design. I mean, I think like a lot of pitchers of his age, and especially those who grew up in the Dominican, Pedro's a pretty powerful figure to try to model yourself after. But yeah, I mean, that whip-like delivery, I'm sure, can be a challenge to repeat over and over again.
And to be fair, you know, his first three innings against, in his second start against the Guardians, looked really good. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he had six strikeouts through three. I thought maybe the third inning in particular, like, it was one of the better changeups we've seen from Castillo in some time. That's a pitch that he really got away from last year. That, of course, you know, years ago was his calling card. That's what he was most known for. It took him to All-Star games. So it wasn't like in his last start it was subpar the whole time. I think it just, for whatever reason, it diminished as his night went on.
Let me go back to something you mentioned earlier. I wanted to follow up on it, and that is that you know, the Mariners saw the most, would you say, the most spin by or the fewest number of fastballs by such a large margin in the league. And you said, I don't see that continuing, at least not at that level. Are you sure? I'm wondering, like, hey, if I'm another team and I'm looking at this and I saw the amount of success that a team had doing that against the Mariners, A, not only would I be looking to do it myself against them, you know, we chatted with Passan, who was pointing out that the number of fastballs has essentially decreased by about a percentage point a year over the last 5 or 6 years. And I do wonder if at some point more pitchers work backwards and we do see fewer and fewer fastballs in the league.
Well, you know, I think this is, like, for me, this is such a fun conversation because I think people want to chalk up offense being down to velocity.
Mm-hmm.
And that does play a factor. There's no question. Last year, the average four-seam fastball was 94 miles an hour. That is the highest it's ever been. I mean, like, if you go back to whenever, the 90s, like, if a guy's blowing 94, you're like, whoa, this guy's pumping some heat. You know, like, the Randy Johnsons of the world were the aliens. Now, there are more and more Randy Johnsons, not to his skill level, but to his stuff level. Really, in my mind, it's the spin, right? There's more spin. It's being thrown at greater velocity, and there are more guys than every staff doing exactly that. And the Mariners are leading the charge there. I mean, this is one of the reasons why the Mariners' pitching staff has been so great is because although they do have a fastball-dominant rotation, they still have so much spin, especially in that bullpen. Just look at Andrés Muñoz. Like, there's a reason why Muñoz throws his slider more than his 99-mile-an-hour fastball. The slider is harder to hit, you know, than a 100-mile-an-hour heater. Going back to your other question, I think it's a fair one. When the season's said and done, will the Mariners be the team that sees the fewest amount of four- and two-seam fastballs? Maybe. Like, somebody has to be at the bottom of that list, right?
Right.
But I guess my point is I don't think it'll be to this extreme level. Right now, just four- and two-seam fastballs, 30%. So it's 70% cutters, changeups, sliders, curveballs, splitters,
yep,
you name it. The thing is, and I talked to Scott Servais about this prior to game one against Cleveland. I asked him, how much harder is it to hit a fastball if you don't see any fastballs? And I almost couldn't get my question out before he said, it is so much harder.
Right.
I think that's the thing, right? Like, your fastball as a pitcher will play up if you're just throwing a bunch of junk up there, a bunch of spin. Now, all of a sudden, your 95-mile-an-hour heater looks like, I don't know, 98. But the other thing is, I don't know if you remember, this is a super grain of sand on the homestand. Mitch Haniger had an at-bat late in the game against a Red Sox reliever. And it was just sweeper, sweeper, sweeper. And one thing that stood out to me about the Red Sox, and one of the reasons why I think that it might not be to this level, is they had a bullpen in particular that was just spotting one sweeper to a right-handed hitter after another. I mean, they were never a ball out of hand, almost never. They were right there on the edge or just off the plate. And Mitch had seen, I don't know how many breaking balls right on the corner or just off that he's fouling off, fighting away. And then he pops in, like, pitch six or seven or eight of the at-bat, He pops in a 95-mile-an-hour heater right over the plate. Mitch gets locked up, strike three called. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure every fan in the stands is like, what are you doing? You just took 95 down the chute. You're Mitch Haniger. Move the bat forward. But what Scott told me was, I've got no problem with Mitch taking that pitch. As a big league hitter, you can only cover so much, right? The guy's got a split and a sweep and a fastball. And all he's doing is throwing you splitters and sweepers. Like, you can't cover three pitches in three areas of the plate. You can't cover the fastball middle in, the splitter at the knees and below, and the sweeper off the plate and on the edge. Like, you just can't. I don't care how good of a hitter you are, even if you're Mitch Haniger. So you have to start to eliminate something in your process, and Mitch eliminated the fastball, and they popped him one. Like, it's a hard game. That's what you have to do. I don't think it's going to be 30% for the rest of the year. To your point, do they see the most when game 62 rolls around? Yeah, maybe. They have to prove. They have to prove they can do something to it.
Or at least lay off of it and allow those pitches to go and start to work your walks again. No accident that the game where they finally broke out offensively was the game where they actually took some walks and put a little more traffic on the base paths that way. All right. Unfortunately, we have to go. I could sit here talking baseball with you for the rest of the morning, but we're out of time. But have fun in Milwaukee and Toronto. Hopefully we start to see a little bit better baseball than we watched yesterday. I have a feeling we will. Aaron, thank you. We appreciate it. Talk soon.
Wonderful to talk to you, Michael. See you, dude.
How great is Aaron Goldsmith? Honestly, I mean, fantastic play-by-play guy, obviously, and we've gotten to know that over the last few years, decade, I guess, now. But really, really tremendous as a radio guest as well. Really informative. A couple of things really jumped out to me there, and the first of which was, you know, the idea of the green overlay box. I think that's really interesting, right? Like, hey, it's not just that we want you swinging at strikes. We want you swinging at these strikes. So you show it, you put it, you try to, you know, implant it into the minds of the players so that by the time the game rolls around, they know where they're trying to lock in and hit. It's a great concept. We obviously haven't seen it pay off yet, but it's a really interesting idea and a great way of kind of starting a process of getting them to choose their pitch. What concerned me a little bit, and I am going to come back to this a little bit later, is why are only a couple of guys actually going through the process and trying to use the strategy that is sort of in place for the whole team? You got to buy in. You got to have everybody do it. And that's going to be something that Scott and Brant Brown, they're going to have to make that happen here in the early part of this season. Okay. Coming up, Maura, you have said something in the past as we were driving back from Tacoma last night. I said, you know what? We have to make sure we talk about this tomorrow because it's one of those things that's easy to hear, but maybe you don't understand it fully until you're in the middle of it. I'll explain next. Brock and Salk, Seattle Sports on 710 and the Seattle Sports app.